A lot of stuff in music to me, it's like everything is a challenge, and that's part of why it's fun.
Welcome to the Banjo Studio Podcast from Banjo Studio, your source for the finest in North American made banjos and Collins guitars and mandolins. Go to banjostudio.com on the web for an incredible selection of instruments and accessories. Hello, the following interview from April 25th, 2020 is with Chris Eldridge, member of the Punch Brothers and live from here and founded the infamous String Dusters. He's recorded with many people from Fiona Apple and Paul Simon to John Paul Jones and Justin Timberlake, and he's a phenomenal guitarist and a true master of the Dreadnought guitar.
I wanted to ask you to start off with just a few things about how you've moved your playing. I mean, it seems like, you know, coming from the background in guitar that you were in, and then now what you do, let's say with the Punch Brothers or anything like this, these are very, very long form compositional type things in that. And how, I'm wondering how you make the transition to that. I mean, the long form thing is very interesting. Having non-repeating sections much and things like that to go on is a very interesting feature to morph one's playing into. So I'm wondering about that development.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I mean, to me, it kind of always felt very natural. Mm-hmm. I mean, with Punch Brothers, we're basically just trying to play and make music that we like, basically, that we all kind of like. That's the goal of the band is, you know, everybody, it's a democracy. I mean, obviously Chris Thiele wields a stronger influence than anybody else. He's very type A, and he's like, you know, so totally brilliant. But you know, we're trying to kind of build that music up from the ground up as well. And we all the reason the five of us found each other is we had this commonality of growing up in the bluegrass world, growing up kind of playing fiddle tunes and at bluegrass festivals, and you know, with this background of playing these string band instruments that don't really necessarily play super well with others. Like, I mean, they can, of course, a banjo can do anything, but it's like, it's really most at home with a mandolin, a guitar, a bass, and a fiddle. So I think the reason that our band even started was because we were all sort of kindred spirits, in the sense that while, yes, we did grow up playing these instruments and we came from this music, you know, especially as kids, we all have always had kind of big ears and loved the width and breadth of music that was available to us. So in a way, I kind of don't feel like it was much of a stretch actually to start playing longer form music, because it always just sort of struck me as just music. You know, it didn't seem really much different to me than anything else. Uh-huh. I mean, you know, playing a fiddle tune, that almost seems weirder to me than playing like a Punch Brothers song relative uh-huh. to most of the music in the world. Because there's something so mechanical about playing a fiddle tune, and there's something so, you know, you're trying to render this tune with a certain kind of rhythm, and you're trying to kind of improvise and dance around a melody in a certain way. I mean, it's kind of a weird, super unique thing. And from my perspective, I know probably nobody else sees it this way, but from my perspective, Punch Brothers thing just almost seems more kind of in line with what everybody else is doing musically. In the sense that, like, yeah, just a fiddle tune is so weird. Like, that's just a strange tradition.
Now, let me ask a couple questions about that. I'll ask one technical and one not. The fact that you find that a strange tradition, I mean, is my understanding is that wasn't your dad in the seldom scene? And
he was, yeah.
And you were around a lot of that music. I mean, I've heard a lot of their records, and it was a wonderful background to be from. But the idea that it's still strange music to you is, I want to explore that a little bit more.
Well, what I mean by that, I mean, is that is that it's not like a lot of other musics. I mean, it's very natural and native to me, mm-hmm. But I feel like the essence of playing a fiddle tune is kind of different than a lot of other stuff. I mean, there's a lot of improvising that goes on with it, at least in the way that we kind of did it when we were all growing up. Mm-hmm. You know, you kind of learn a tune and you play ahead. And in that sense, it's kind of like jazz. I mean, there's where the music is kind of built around a certain kind of improvising and a certain kind of virtuosity. It's actually a lot, you know, it has a lot in common with like Texas style fiddling. That there's a whole tradition of that where people kind of, you know, have these tunes and then improvise around them a lot. I guess just not a lot of other, when I think of Punch Brothers music, it seems so, it's pretty composed, you know, we kind of work out our parts, not unlike Radiohead or, you know, a lot of other rock bands that, the Beatles, you know, I mean, there's a lot of, and of course I'm not putting us in that realm, but I'm just, they pop to mind, as just like great bands that, you know, have parts. And I think a lot of bands play music with parts, and that's almost what I, what seems normal and regular about Punch Brothers. It's like the forms are bigger and longer, I suppose, than some other things, but it also just kind of feels like, I don't know. It feels like a lot of other music to me. Just, we try and be, you know, we try to be creative and harmonically interesting. And we want all the elements. We want the rhythms to be interesting, and we want the performance to be compelling. Mm-hmm. And we want the song to go places where you don't expect that it would, but it's like, it doesn't seem so different than a lot of the rest of the music that like, I think a lot of people listen to.
Uh-huh.
So does that make sense? Yeah,
it does. I mean, there's two things. I mean, yeah, I mean, I totally understand, because the Punch Brothers ensemble playing, the way that you all play together is, it's an unbelievable texture and textural control that you all have with each other, and just very beautiful ensemble playing. I mean, I can't really say enough about that, but it sounds to me like you're speaking about, languages of improvisation style that go on in fiddle music.
I just think that's kind of a weird and very specific tradition. I guess that's all I meant by that.
That's interesting.
But that's kind of where we came from. Yeah.
Yeah. So, do you, let's say you're playing these different styles, do you have preferences for different fields of guitar, or do you use the same guitar no matter what kind of stuff you're playing now? Did you just get yourself built one all-encompassing beautiful Collings that you like to use for everything, or do you?
Oh, well, you know, no, I mean, I've got a lot of guitars, and they kind of all do different things. You know, I mean, I really enjoyed working with Collings on, you know, we were just kind of, sort of standing on the shoulders of some of what they'd figured out with Julian Lage, in the JL series, which those are great guitars. Mm-hmm. And I think through that kind of prototyping and just learning process, when I started talking to them about making a better dreadnought, we were able to kind of, we had a nice head start. I think, I mean, Collings, I admire them so much. Their manufacturing abilities, their precision, and their repeatability, just the way that they're able to do that and make good instruments, mm-hmm. That, you know, can, that a musician would, you know, want to play, is really remarkable. The Collings, I'm really psyched about some of the guitars that we worked on together. I don't necessarily play them exclusively. I mean, I've nothing's going to replace my old Martins. But the Collings is like it's a great guitar for me to travel with. Mm-hmm. It's something that feels, reliable and it just feels reliable and musical, and it's a good foil. And also, if, you know, something happened to it, it wouldn't be the end of the world. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's really nice to have something that's that's of a really high quality, but also fundamentally just also really utilitarian. Whereas a lot of these old Martins, you know, they're utilitarian in a way, but you know, you certainly wouldn't want to have, you know, have to check your 30s, you know, D28 and, you know, have it smashed to bits when you go to baggage claim. You know, it's just not, there's so much more in that. They're so valuable. They have, you know, and I don't, you know, spirit is a funny thing, but there is something sort of sacred about them. They're these objects that have been around, and people have imbued them with so much love and meaning. I mean, a guitar has lived intimately with people, and people felt intimate about them. And I feel like with an object, with a physical object, there's something kind of cool and mystical that just kind of, it gets imbued with when it's had that kind of life. And so, yeah, the old Martins just feel they're so special and so singular. And so to have something like the Collings, that's really great, but maybe a little bit more utilitarian, at least for my purposes, is something I'm really grateful for.
Yeah, interesting. And another thing I wanted to ask you about, so you've played with so many wonderful people, you know, as it should be, and your records are amazing that way too. But I know when you were, so you obviously grew up around a lot of the music or a lot of the sound styles or sound texture that you work in. But when you studied with Tony Rice, who's also a very forward looking musician in a way, out of a similar, you know, in as much as he cut, again, there was a master traditional background or way that you're supposed to do it, and he made great strides with that. What did you learn from him? How did your studies with him work? What did you learn from?
Well, he was kind of like my mentor. I went to Oberlin College, and at Oberlin there's a program in January called Winter Term, where traditional classes are kind of put on hold, and the idea is that you design a project, you know, with a faculty advisor, and you execute it during that month. Mm-hmm. And it could be anything. I mean, it could literally be anything, and people have done all kinds of crazy and wonderful projects. But my dream at that point was, like, a friend of mine asked me, he was like, what do you want to do for winter term? I was like, man, I don't know. I can't figure it out. And he said, what would you like to do most in the world? I was like, well, obviously I'd like to go study with Tony Rice, but there's no way that's going to happen. And my friend said, why don't you know him? Right. I was like, yeah, you know, cause my dad, you know, they're old friends, and Tony's like kind of an old family friend.
Oh, okay.
And yeah, my dad played on one of his records back in the day, and he used to stay at the house. He would stay at the house before I was born, but you know, they were just old buddies, and so I kind of knew Tony. So I called him up and said, hey, I've got this thing for school where I've got some time. I know it's a long shot, but could I come down there and, you know, study with you? And he just said, yeah, come on down. That sounds cool. Much to my complete surprise, because, you know, Tony is very reclusive, really. You know, he doesn't really let people in very much. Mm-hmm. And so I went down there, and we I was only there for about a week. I wasn't there for a whole month, but we kind of just sat and talked about music. We didn't, the whole time I was there, we did not play one single tune together. Uh-huh. So him being my teacher was not about playing guitar or how to be a, you know, quote unquote, better guitar player or more technical guitar player or anything like that. We didn't talk about that at all. What we talked about was music. Uh-huh. We talked about being a musician. Like, why are you a musician? Mm-hmm. You know, we had these great conversations, and Tony is a really, really smart, really, really wise person. Mm-hmm. And so it just, that we kind of changed my perspective on music and being a musician and the kind of musician that I wanted to be. Mm-hmm. And you know, because I always think I was 19 when I went down there. Mm-hmm. And at that point, I kind of was interested in being like just an epic, like mind-blowing guitar shredder. You know, I wanted to play crazy stuff on guitar that there was like, you know, nobody had ever heard before, which, you know, I probably couldn't have done anyway. But that's kind of where my head was, you know, which is a very sort of juvenile way of thinking about these things. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to be really amazing. And what Tony kind of pointed out to me is that, you know, where it's really at is just, you know, what you're really doing as a musician, and this is paraphrasing what he said, but I'll, you know, it's kind of guided me and I think always will. He said, you really just want to collaborate with your fellow musicians to make sounds that are pleasing to the ear. Mm-hmm. He's like, that's kind of what it's all about. Mm-hmm. That's what, you know, and whatever form that takes. And, you know, so I never took that as it needed to sound like smooth or even be harmonious, you mm-hmm. know, I mean, because I think you could have super skronky avant-garde music that, mm-hmm. that, in its own way would be passing that test. But his point was like, it's not about that. It's about, you're kind of there to be in service of music. Music is sound mm-hmm. with soul that's going to be received by other people. And your job is to do the best job you can to bring that sound into being in a beautiful way with your fellow musicians. Uh-huh. And it's like, obviously we all kind of know that, but, I think it just really changed my perspective, you know, because I was, you know, I was pretty gifted, I guess. And I kind of was on this certain, path. I was kind of concerned with certain things that were maybe a little bit more, centered around me, you know, mm-hmm. and it kind of just shifted. It kind of allowed me to kind of shift my ego out of it a little bit more and try and be someone who was less kind of focused on the me of it and more on the kind of the bigger picture, which I think I'm forever grateful for. Mm-hmm. But it really, I mean, I hope that doesn't sound like I don't know. It's funny talking about it like that, but that was really the change. I mean, he got me to be less focused on myself and more focused on the idea of music as this big sacred thing that we're all just trying to like honor and be a part of.
Uh-huh, yeah. Wonderful. And, let's see, here's a question I want to talk to you about, because you have to be out all kinds of ways. I want to talk to you about what your preferences are and how you find the challenge of amplifying and miking acoustic guitars for a lot yeah. of things and for recording as well. I mean, how do you treat that? It's a huge, difficult subject. I mean, I have
yeah. Acoustic guitar is brutal, especially, it's always tough, because it can be so boomy, you know, but the boom, the kind of, there's this real sweet spot in the low end of the guitar, that to me is so essential to the sound, and especially the sound of like a dreadnought, you know, bluegrass guitar, especially as defined by Tony Rice, who, you know, who will always be kind of my hero. And kind of like North Star in terms of just how great a dreadnought can sound when you're playing bluegrass. Uh-huh. And so that's, it's a tricky thing. If you kind of tune out all the low end, it makes a guitar fit in, with a band better, but then you kind of lose that essential, support that a guitar provides. Like a lot of times I think about a string band as being kind of analogous to a drum set. Uh-huh. And that there are no drums, so everybody in the band has to have a lot of rhythmic responsibility. Mm-hmm. So, you know, string band musicians tend to be pretty rhythmically strong, You know, everybody has to, there can be no weak links in the chain.
Uh-huh.
And, but also if you accept the premise then that it's like a drum kit, then all the different instruments kind of then sort of correspond to different drums in terms of just like register. And so I always kind of think of guitar as the essential nature of a guitar in a string band is being more like a tom,
mm-hmm.
As opposed to a mandolin, which is obviously the snare or, you know, so, yeah, it's like, how do you get it to fill that kind of tom role, down low? And it's hard. What I came to is, I've got a 1954 D28 that I've played a lot, over the years. Mm-hmm. It's a guitar I call Uncle Johnny. And it's, I put a pickup in it about, oh, I don't know, 4 years ago at the urging of Brian Sutton, who...
Great guitar player.
Super master. Yeah, Brian's unbelievable. Anyway, Brian, I was kind of talking to him about trying to have a good, you know, live guitar sound. And he just encouraged me to go ahead and just go for putting a pickup in this old guitar. And what it was going to mean and what I was so resistant about was I was going to have to drill out the end pin jack. Uh-huh. And I just didn't want to violate this old instrument that way. Uh-huh. Now, of course, Uncle Johnny is anything but a collector's guitar. I mean, it had a bolt-on bridge at one point. And you can't see that now, but it's like if you look inside with a mirror, that guitar, you know, it is not a collector's piece. So anyway, I kind of eventually relented and did what Brian said, and it was such good advice. I'm so grateful because that guitar just sounds good. I think it's easy to get a good sound if you have a good instrument. I think that's probably the single most important element. And and it seems weird that on an acoustic guitar, you know, something where we experience the whole experience of it occurs acoustically in a room, that if you put a transducer inside of it, like on the bridge, that a good guitar, you know, guitar that's good acoustically, that somehow that would translate to that, you know, pickup inside the guitar. It seems crazy, but I think it actually is true. I think a good instrument is just a good instrument, and it resonates in a certain way. And so that for me was a really good thing to do it with that guitar. And then as far as the pickups that we're using, I've got a LR Bags Lyric in there, mm-hmm. and a Joe Mills microphone that Joe Glazer installed both of those. And Joe Glazer here in Nashville. And he wired them together so that they both come out of one single TRS jack. So I've got a stereo jack in the end of the guitar, and they run via a stereo cable to a Grace Felix, which is a fantastic little box made by, you know, Grace Design in Lyons, Colorado. And the Felix, you know, it can decode the two signals. You plug in a TRS cable and it can split it into the two channels.
Wow.
And it has a bunch of, you know, EQ options. It's got a parametric EQ, which is huge. It's hugely important for amplifying an acoustic guitar. And it just has good, it's like a Swiss Army knife. So that's the basic thing. And then there's an effects loop, on the Felix, and I've got another three band parametric EQ that I run out of the effects loop, uh-huh. just so I can have a little bit more control over resonances because it is kind of, you know, the thing that I just said about the having a good instrument being important to getting a good, like amplified pickup acoustic guitar sound, I do think uh-huh. is true, but there are also a bunch of crazy weird resonances that just are going to be occurring inside the box. So the reason to use the reason to have more parametric EQ available is that you can really just dial in these weird problem frequencies that are just inordinately loud. Like I only use the parametric stuff to kind of pinpoint very specific frequencies that are kind of getting out of control, and try and bring them back into line. So, So yeah, that's kind of the trick that I've come up with. And it, you know, it works. It doesn't sound like a guitar sitting in front of studio microphones, but it, I think it works pretty well, and it's highly functional, and it's and I can kind of lose myself in it when I'm playing. So, which I think is maybe the most important thing. And then I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, please go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, as far as recording, I've tried a bunch of different things over the years and had a bunch of good experience with a lot of different methods. But, these days I've got, KM84s are just wonderful acoustic guitar mics, or a KM86, which is, literally the exact same processor and microphone capsule as a KM84. It's just, you know, the two sides, and it looks a little different, but it's actually the same mic. Those are killer acoustic guitar mics. They will kind of always lead to a good sound, I've found. So if there's nothing more kind of fancy or esoteric or fun available, like, boy, you just really can't go wrong with KM84s. They're or 86s. They're really great. But I've enjoyed trying to, on this last Punch Brothers record, we had a setup where we used a nickel capsule microphone. I've got a KM88, which is, and by the way, I know I'm getting like super dorky here.
No, I think it's good. It's good. You know, okay. Something really good, because it's a big problem for people who are playing acoustic instruments with bands and stuff in live places. And I think it comes up for everybody. So I think it's, you know, when you're hearing somebody who's so experienced with it, like you are, it's, I think it's important for people.
Yeah. Well, like the nickel capsule microphones, like these old Neumann, like KM54s and KM56s, they actually had different diaphragms that were made of nickel, and they're much quicker. They're very kind of precise sounding. They are extremely very articulate. I guess that's kind of the word. Mm-hmm. What I have is something called a KM88, which is there were some leftover capsules from the KM. They quit making the KM56s, and they had quit making any microphones Neumann had that used these nickel capsules, and they just had these things sitting around. And so at some point in, I don't know, the 70s, they decided to make a new microphone that was not a tube mic, but that used up these nickel capsules. So I've got one, that's a KM88, and I've got a KM88. And we, for the last Punch record, we used that in conjunction with a Beyer Dynamic M160, which is a ribbon mic. It's like a little hypercardioid ribbon mic. Yeah. And those two things, and you know, it's kind of more, it's got more of a woody sound, for lack of a better word. You know, it really complements the KM88. What one mic does, the other one doesn't, and vice versa, in the best way possible. Mm-hmm. And so that wound up being kind of the main acoustic guitar sound. And I'm really happy with how it kind of all worked out. Also, I love using just an AEA, like I've got, you know, AEA R84 is a beautiful sounding mic. I really like ribbon mics on acoustic guitars, like a combination of a ribbon. If you're not going to do like a KM84, you know, which is to me kind of the simple, straightforward and pretty widely available thing, I like, you know, those nickel capsule microphones along with a ribbon. Those two things kind of really complement each other in a gorgeous way. But you know, all of that said, you know, that's, we're talking like fairly high end stuff here. You know, you can get a great guitar sound, with anything, just making sure that you have good mic placement, that you're not going to, you know, mic it in a way where the guitar is super boomy. You know, if you try and have good practices in terms of phase, if you're using multiple microphones so that they're not, you know, so that you can either get the capsules as close as possible, or you can align them in sort of an XY configuration, so which helps eliminate phase issues. Those things, they sound boring to talk about, but they really help. And you know, just not miking a guitar too close. I think that's a big thing. I think a lot of people, especially, you know, if you're recording at home or you haven't been fortunate enough to be, you know, in fancy studios with like super fancy engineers, you might think that, you know, you put your headphones on if you got your little mic at home and you're going to record something, and the guitar just sounds bigger and more powerful if you have the mic really close to the guitar. And there's an effect where we tend to like things that are louder. Mm-hmm. Like if you play someone two sounds that are identical, with the exception that one is louder than the other, 10 times out of 10, people will think that the louder one sounds better. So it's this sort of psychoacoustical effect that can happen, mm-hmm. where we kind of mistake loudness for sounding good. Mm-hmm. And so I'd say, like, for anybody who's working on stuff at home, try and watch out for that. Like, you don't want to be too close to the mics. You'll get a really boomy, muddy sound. A little more space than you expect will probably translate well out of the speakers.
Mm-hmm. Great. That's a really great answer. Thank you very much. It's funny because I was pretty wondering. I watched your live from home thing that went up earlier. That was looking at the mic configuration. So
it's that was here at the house right now. Yeah, I've got the KM88 and an R84 is kind of what I've, and I did a couple of them with some other stuff. But yeah, that's a good combo. Those two things, a ribbon mic and a nickel. And a nickel diaphragm microphone really can complement each other beautifully.
Terrific. I want to ask just two more brief questions, and then thank you for giving us the time.
Totally.
One is, I like to ask, is where do you see yourself going from here? What do you have on the horizon? What are you hoping to accomplish? I mean, since you've done so
much. Well, I at some point I would actually like to make a solo record, and which is, you know, despite all of all the stuff I was saying earlier, I think I've kind of avoided that. I've kind of like built my thing around trying to be a really good ensemble musician and help bring the music to life in that way. And I think I've really probably neglected and even at a certain point started to run from kind of just owning stuff myself. So my next goal is to make a solo record, you know, kind of go ahead and take responsibility is kind of how I look at it, for kind of just stepping out front because it to me, it just seems like a fun challenge. A lot of stuff in music to me, it's like everything is a challenge, and that's part of why it's fun. You know, it's crazy that, you know, anybody who's a professional musician, that we get to do this for a living. I mean, it's such an incredible gift that I know I certainly don't ever take for granted, because kind of what it represents to me is something where I get to pursue my curiosity and have challenges and get to try and meet them in like a cool, creative way. And hopefully, you know, you have something beautiful to show for it. Mm. And so, but the fact that everything is kind of a challenge, that's kind of what it all has in common to me. And when I look back on things that have happened in the past, it's a great privilege. And so that kind of seems like the next challenge, that I'm looking forward to and frankly am like totally scared of, but I look forward to kind of like getting in there and trying to make something really, really good if I can.
Yeah. Running that fear. It's interesting because, you were talking there about the privilege of making a living playing music. And I was, thinking it's interesting generationally, because it seems like in your father's band, they seldom seen everyone had another job.
Yeah. Was so crazy because they did not intend to be professional musicians. It was like, It was actually literally an accident. And I don't know of another band like that. And so I think I grew up with this warped sense that, oh yeah, you can go have your like normal job and then, you know, be in like a really killer band making these, you know, killer records, which, I mean, of course you can, but it's just to do it on the level that they did it at is extremely rare. I don't really know of many people across all of music that have kind of done it like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were just all guys who liked to get together and pick, and it sort of just got out of control, and people really, whatever they were doing was really moving people. And that was that. They kind of, but I think, you know, part of the Seldom Scenes are really, especially the classic Seldom Scene, you know, the original band, when they formed and kind of made such an impact on the scene, on the bluegrass scene, I think it was because they were so different. You know, they didn't really sound at all like anybody else. And I think part of that was that they didn't feel any pressure to have to sound like anybody else because they all had jobs. You know, this was really something that they were pursuing for their own amusement and the fun of it. I mean, I think obviously they took music seriously because they're like great musicians who made great music. And so that doesn't happen by accident, but it's not like they felt any pressure about it. I've always thought that was really cool. Like if they had been full-time musicians, like would it have worked? I don't know.
Yeah. Well, listen, I don't want to take up any more of your time than you've granted us, which is very kind. Thank you very much for doing this on behalf of Banjo Studio and also for your contribution to music. And I hope it keeps coming out and you come out of this and able to continue doing incredible stuff.
Well, thank you so much. Thanks for talking to me and letting me yammer on about all this stuff. And it's a pleasure. And I look forward to seeing you guys in New Orleans next time. Thanks. I'm down there.
I look forward to seeing you too. Take care.
Yeah. Okay. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Banjo Studio Podcast with your host, Jonathan Frelick. Head over to banjostudio.com for a great selection of American-made banjos and Collings guitars.